V.E. Day, the 8th of May, 1945, 50 years ago tomorrow. And 50 years ago they were celebrating, just as we are, commemorating the 50th anniversary this weekend, when the lights went on again, as the song said, all over the world. There was dancing and street parties everywhere, flags flew and red, white and blue bunting was in abundance. The crowds gathered, excited crowds, full of relief and anticipation. The war, 6 long years of wearying war across the world, with all its deprivation and hardship, had finally come to an end. Cause for celebration indeed, and Britain went mad with patriotic fervour and delight. But actually, it wasn't all over. It was only in Europe that the war had ended. In the Far East and the Pacific, the war against the Japanese still went on. Lives were being lost, and victory was not to come for another 4 months. The forgotten army in the Far East was still slogging it out through dense jungles, fighting an often unseen enemy. Here at home, in the excitement of the moment, the Far East was put out of mind. The victory celebrations were the celebrations of service men and women and civilians who would live to see the promised bright tomorrow. But many families had little to celebrate. They were counting the cost in lives lost and the cost in severely damaged lives, the loved ones who would never return, and those who, though returning, would never be the same again. During the next 90 minutes, we're going to meet some of those who came through it all as they recall just a few experiences from long days of World War II. Their memories are as bright and vivid 50 years on as if it happened yesterday. Many of these stout-hearted survivors recall those dark days with a great deal of humour. They represent all the armed services and the people I've met over the last 5 or 6 years whilst making my regular Sunday evening programmes here on Radio 2. Our 90-minute journey will take us from the Baltic to the Mediterranean and from the beaches of Dunkirk and Normandy to the great castle at Colditz in Saxony as we hear a little about the price of victory.
It's a lovely day tomorrow. Tomorrow is a lovely day. Tomorrow's clear blue skies.
After only a few months of World War II, the French army, the Belgian army and their allies who'd rushed their aid, the British Expeditionary Force, found themselves beaten back to the English Channel by the might of the German fighting machine. With their backs to the beaches, there was only one way out, across the sea. So, the miracle of Dunkirk was born. Over 11 days, more than a third of a million men were rescued and brought back to Britain's shores in Operation Dynamo.
The left flank of the rear guard had been exposed by the fall of the Belgian army. And there was 10 Grenadier Guardsmen from Royal Engineers, RASC, Medium Regiment Gunners. They were all flung in as infantry. We were supported by the 12th Lancers. Then we proceeded to Coxsides on the Dunkirk-Newport Canal to hold a bridge. Yeah. And those German motorcycle troops at that time, which were the advance reconnaissance force of the 15th German Army, were fully within view. And the Allies had placed the mines under the bridge to blow it.
Yeah.
They went down to the plunger. Yeah. Nothing happened. And this young Royal Engineers officer, he had to go back underneath the bridge under intense fire and reconnect the terminals on the mines and get back, which he done. He's a very brave man. And meantime, the Germans were shelling us with these heavy 150mm guns. We had quite a few casualties.
Yeah.
I think this was all sand dunes, 50 or 60 foot high probably. Sand dunes were a godsend because you could butter into the sand so quickly, and these German fighter planes and bombers were strapping the beaches, obviously.
Yeah, and bombing it.
And as I dropped them, they just didn't, you know, with all the sand that's about.
We brought many, many, many loads of ammunition back here. We lost the guns, obviously, lost item, because there was one great melange of people and lorries, and it was one mass of people one mass exodus from the north of Belgium, coming across down through Coxeed here. This is where we landed, down on this area here. For some unexplicable reason, the both her guns were destroyed. Consequently, all the ammo that we've got here was of no consequence at all. The lorries were destroyed, and subsequently, anything that was any, of any use to the Germans. We were caught up in masses and masses of refugees that were flowing from all corners of the of this little area here. They were coming from Holland. They were
bedlam.
Absolutely. And, of course, we were on the roads trying to get through. And when the Mr. Schmitz came down gunning the roads, they were after the civilians as much as they were after the army.
But when you got this far, now you got your back to the sea.
Nowhere you could go.
Go.
No.
So were you scared?
You know, there's comfort in numbers when you've got your comrades around you. When we went, tried to get out into the water there, every time we got near to what we thought was a boat approaching us, there was a raid and we all had to scarp again into the dunes.
Yeah, because
you lost your place in a queue. We were very fortunate, there were six of us. There was a raid. We all dispersed. We found ourselves isolated just on a little patch here, perched on our feet because we dropped at the water's edge. And they're coming across the water there. Was a motor torpedo boat, and it had on the back of it six little rowboats, all tied gunwale to gunwale. One came loose, one of our lads into the water, away, got that, signaled us. We waded out and then swam out. With great difficulty, we all got in there. We got out there to several vessels, turned away, they're all full up, finally reached the SS Waverley, which is a the old paddle steamer, steamer.
The Beachmasters tried to get troops lined in single file from the dunes down to the sea so that the small boats that came in could take the first 30.
Was it pretty orderly?
There was always a panic when the aircraft came down and we had to dive back in the dunes, and then you were wondering why you weren't in the same place when the queue was formed again. Well, the main boats couldn't come right into the beach because of that sand beach in the middle there. And so they had to use little small boats to ferry us to the big boats. A lot of chaps just waded out and swam out to boats, but it doesn't look very far, but it's quite a way.
What was your biggest problem?
The biggest problem we found in this area was civilians blocking the roads. The road along to Dunkirk from here was a mass of refugees and trucks and trolleys and carts and people, and everything was on fire. There was horses being dumped in the canal, some with the carts still tied to them. And
really?
It was an awful sight. Whenever I come along that road, I always think about that.
I bet you do.
It's one of the things that sticks in my mind.
Do you ever have any qualms about getting away?
I don't think I did, no. I think eventually we all thought we'd get away, but of course a lot didn't.
Most of the main crowd moved out. There was a lot left behind to destroy the guns and any equipment that was surplus, and then the day after that we just was told to head for the beach. As a fighting unit, we'd ceased some 2 days before we got to Dunkirk, and then when we seen the situation there, it was suggested that we move farther up the beach as there's a better chance of getting away. We come up to La Panne, and that was under shell fire from Jim, so we started to go back again. And back past Bray Dunes, we found the shortest queue, and the little boats had come into operation. Having watched a couple of destroyers vanish, one with a bomb down the funnel, we didn't consider the future very bright, so it was look for the first boat. A bit of pushing and shoving and heaving, but if anybody looks a bit the worse for wear or was wounded, they was pushed to the front of the queue. Now a turn came when the old Ramsgate lifeboat pops up. It looked like a pepper box to us, but it was salvation, and we were all aboard and took out to a, what we found later on was a Dutch coal barge, and sort of unceremoniously bundled into the whole of that. And we got back into Ramsgate the 1st of June.
We'd come from over the canal. The canal is running parallel with the sea.
Yes.
And they put all the vehicles in the canal, and we crossed over in the vehicles, standing on the vehicles across the
sea.
And we took up a position by the red-roofed house.
Got it.
And the whole idea of the exercise was to protect the evacuation from this area. And we stopped on the 29th of May. On the night of the 29th of May, we had orders to withdraw towards the Dunkirk perimeter. We passed through the 2nd French Army. You know, they were digging in and we were leapfrogging back again to just about 4 kilos from Dunkirk. Mm-hmm. And then we hit the beach.
Yeah.
In orderly fashion, we marched then down to Dunkirk and we embarked on the 1st of June.
How close did Jerry get to you?
Very close. 300 yards, 400 yards.
Oh,
their infantry. And we were
have a crowd
infantry,
you
know. And they took a lot of our fellows, prisoners.
Yeah.
And, unfortunately, the lads were tired.
Yeah.
And they fell asleep. And the night when we withdrew, we left a lot of them behind and they were eventually taken prisoner.
Yeah.
When we started on the retreat, actually, towards the beaches, we found it necessary to discard and abandon all the vehicles, which we couldn't take through to the beaches. We only took through a doctor's truck and a catering truck.
I see.
All the other vehicles we abandoned, and because of the crowds and the crush on the roads, they were all abandoned by tipping into the canals. When we reached the beaches, the troops were wading out into the sea, and it was proving very difficult for them to get far enough out by just walking into the sea and walking out to the ships. And Colonel Perrott, who was the CRE of the 1st Division, he was sitting ruminating on what was happening, and he said, we'll have to have jetties to get them into the ships. So we gathered the various lorries that had got that far. The tires were let down. They were driven down into the sea, and they were loaded with sandbags to weigh them down. And then we decked down on top of the overall decking of the lorries by using flooring boards from the houses on the back edge of the beach. This enabled us to provide jetties that were quite practical for bringing little ships alongside and letting the troops get out and get into the ships in the dry.
You thought you'd lost one of your officers, didn't you, Pat Reed?
Oh, Pat Reed. Pat Reed was the ammunition liaison officer with the 2nd British Division. And when we got back just short of this canal, coming from Cassel, we came to a crossroads where two convoys was a bit too much to go in the same direction. And so Pat turned in one direction and I turned in the other. And Pat ran straight into the bag. He finished up in Colditz, and he was the escape officer for Colditz for many years.
I never forget one thing. That was on the morning on the 4th of June. When I came back to the beaches, Lord Gort was gone about 11 o'clock in the morning, I think. And the beaches, nobody was there. Everybody was gone. There was 328,000 and so much soldiers evacuated, but in the Panne about 180,000. So I know what the British Army have doing for us, for our freedom.
When the Germans came in the morning, my parents or the other people were not allowed to go to the beach. But the young people, the children, they could go. And we went to steal everything. Steal the corned beef from the vans and the lorries. Boxes of tea.
Yes.
Cigarettes, a lot of carted cigarettes.
Yes.
Then we buried the corned beef in the sand, in the garden. And during the war, we ate 4 years corned beef.
We had corn.
With the name of Swift, I don't remember.
Footprints in the dry, soft sand lead down towards the sea, where gentle waves have long caressed these shores of history. Yet never can the ceaseless wash erase the memory of Dunkirk. This is the Panne, where many will recall the carnage on the beaches by the battle-scarred sea wall. The sand dunes are the sentries of men's fortitude and fears. They are the silent witnesses of all those wartime years. And just a gaze across the water of the blue and silver sea, old England isn't far away and home sweet home to me. And that's what Dunkirk's all about, to honour fighting men. And God bless all the little ships who came to rescue them. During World War II, the little island of Malta found itself at a crossroads. Situated at the narrowest point of the Mediterranean, it was directly in the path of the Axis powers en route to their armies in North Africa. At the same time, it was an important staging post for the Allies on their journey from Gibraltar to their bases in Alexandria and the Middle East. Malta was then a British Crown colony, and Hitler's forces had to overcome the island if they were to have unimpeded passage. The day after Mussolini brought Italy into the war, on the 10th of June 1940, the bombing raids started and Malta's long siege ordeal began. Unable to feed themselves, the people of Malta and the defending Allied forces had to be supplied by sea or face starvation. Convoy after convoy of merchant shipping and the naval escorts were decimated as the German and Italian navies and air forces maintained the blockade. But Malta did not submit, and in 1942, King George VI awarded the George Cross to Malta and her people in recognition of their bravery and tenacity.
In 42, the situation was getting worse and worse. The bombing was getting almost insupportable. And April 42 was that crucial month when the bombing got so very severe. And it was at this time that King George VI, on his own initiative, decided to award the whole island of Malta the George Cross. And this did a tremendous amount for their morale and helped them to survive these worst months.
Admiral of the Fleet, Lord Lewin, sets the scene for us.
The George Cross was awarded on the 15th of April. The governor of Malta, General Dobie, and we must recall that Malta at this time was a British colony, he sustained the people of Malta. He was a man of great Christian faith, and he sustained the people of Malta and was highly respected by them. But his health had failed, and he was relieved by General Gort, VC, a tremendous man, an inspiring man. He flew into Malta in September, bringing with him the George Cross, which he presented in a ceremony to the Chief Justice of the island.
I was from the Royal Army Medical Corps. I wanted to get to sea, so I couldn't get transferred to the Navy. But I was put on to the troop ships.
You were the medic on the ship?
I was a medic on the troop ships. And we had different sorts of cargo, ammunition, fuel, and food. Different ships had all sorts of cargo, so that one ship hadn't got everything of the one kind, that there was a mixture of them the ships got through. It was most important that the convoy got through to Malta.
Yes.
And out of the 14 ships that left Great Britain, only three come in the first day, in August 1942, along with the tanker, which was brought in by destroyers, which were on either side of it. It was important that that tanker got through.
Yes.
And Jerry did all his power to get that tanker. But unfortunately, he didn't get it, for it was towed. It was abandoned, and then the crew come back, along with some of the other survivors, and brought the ship into harbour here. I think we lost about 2,000 men in the whole convoy. When we were here, the place, as you understand, was in starvation, Charlie. There was no food. No one was able, you couldn't go and make food in the different houses or anything like that. The people were living in the caves, and the children used to come down to even get the swill from the ships.
I was in the Royal Marine Band Service and spent the whole war at sea. And at this particular time, in 1942, I happened to be on HMS Eagle, which was sunk in Operation Pedestal, the convoy which came along and relieved Morpeth. Eagle was one of the four carriers in Operation Pedestal, which was the large convoy that Churchill decided simply had to get through because at that time the people were starving. And this one, they put out a real armada, four carriers, battleships, cruisers, hundreds of destroyers, as it were, and sailed up and were attacked all the time. Well, Eagle was the first major ship that was sunk on the way in. We were carrying Spitfires, as we had done several times up the Med for Morpeth. They had very little air cover, and I was picked up by the destroyer Lookout. I had a bit of a difficulty getting off because I was on the wrong side. I was on the side that the four torpedoes struck. And therefore, it was going down, and I had to come up from the side that was going down. When she heeled over and the flight deck went in the water, the nets where the air crews used to be in to grab the planes as they landed on, I realised what they were, and I was able to pull myself out on these nets like a big spider in a web and come round the edge of the flight deck and managed to get to the surface.
Luckiest moment started before we got here. Came out on the merchant ship Imperial Star, a Blue Star Line, and we were going through the Pantelleria Straits in the Mediterranean when, in the evening, we were torpedoed by an all-Italian torpedo plane. We were picked up by the destroyer Heythrop, who then took us onto Malta. We arrived in Malta with just a shirt and a pair of shorts on, because they had no gear to give us here. And again, they gave us a khaki army uniform with a flash on her shoulder to denote that we were
Royal. That's marvellous. He's got an airman who's wrecked at sea and they give him an army uniform. Then you were stationed in Malta for the what? How long?
From September 1941 to January 1944.
And the food got a bit rough.
Towards the end, very rough. We were with a small unit where everybody was worked together.
Yeah,
we
mates. On well.
We had a marvellous CO called Barnes who treated us like his own sons. When he got back to England, he went back to England before us, he wrote to all their mothers and fathers or wives, and in some cases he went and visited them when he got back to assure them that we were left here, that we were still all right.
A real gentleman.
Yeah, real gentleman.
We came out with the RAF Express draft brought out by the Navy on HMS Newcastle in November 1940 and went through the Blitz until 1943.
What were you serving with?
148 Squadron, Wellington Bomber.
Were you a flying man or were you ground staff?
No, ground staff. Maintenance and equipping the planes.
The Air Force kept pretty busy, really.
Oh, very busy indeed. Of course, we ran out of parts, spare parts for the planes, you see. And it was only on the second flight of Spitfires with our overload tanks coming off the American aircraft carrier, the Wasp, which we never looked back after that.
Really?
No. They split up the 60 Spitfires, 20 to Halfar, 20 to Luca, 20 to Takali. We had hardly time to get the overload tanks off the planes and get them rearmed. They were up in the air again.
What would you think was about the worst moments?
I can remember crossing the runway at Luca Airfield, going out to the other side to where the aircraft were in pens, and I saw what I thought were hurricanes coming over the reservoir.
Yeah.
And I thought, funny looking, hurricanes. And then the machine gun started, and I fell flat and broke a very good pen, fountain pen I had at that time. Then I realized that hurricanes have inline engines. These had radial engines.
Oh, yes.
So I should have known. I think the worst experience I ever came across, I was in the bathhouse one time and some sense told me there was something wrong. And I gathered up the toilet equipment, etc. Came out and looked up in the sky and waves of bombers coming in. Yeah. And I flew into one of the deep shelters, just with a towel wrapped around. You know? And after the
raid, driver modesty.
No. After the raid, I came out in that particular bathhouse, the particular bath I was in, a direct hit. So
you're a lucky man.
My name wasn't on that.
No, that's
one.
Right. Yeah.
We all suffered, you know. Yes. It was a very bad time.
Yes.
Especially after the Germans came on the 16th of January. They were after the Illustrious.
Oh,
it had been escorting a convoy to Malta.
Yes.
And she'd been hit.
She came here with a list. She got it to Grand Harbour, and the Germans swore that this would be her grave. But they only sent a wrecker plane for 5 days.
Yes.
That gave time to command to organize its defense. Every attack battery that could be spared from outlying districts was brought around the harbour. And the order was, shoot straight up. It was a curtain of steel. The result was only three got through this barrier, and she was hit three times, I think, 225 kilos, 150 kilos. But because it was sloping,
yes.
They got the ones that did no harm at all. They lost a great number of planes. During the attack on the Illustrious, a Maltese diver from the dockyard was working underneath the Illustrious, and he was signaled to come up. He stayed there until he finished his job. When he came up, when they took his helmet off, there was blood coming out of his ears. It was spoken about everywhere at the time.
This due to the pressure?
Yes, from the bombs.
Oh, I see.
Some fell into the sea.
Why is he? And they floated underwater.
Yeah. I call this because it shows the spirit of the Maltese at the time.
You were in the army, of course.
I was in the King's Home Mort Regiment. And we began the war with one regiment, and we finished up with four regiments. First, second, third, and tenth. Not fourth. Tenth. That's from the enemy, you know?
I see. Yes. Oh, that's cute.
I was Royal Artillery, but Alamein came through, and I was here to... we were doing recce for the invasion of Sicily.
Yeah.
We used to go by sub and then by small craft. We also used to take samples on the beaches, you know, for check the beaches that we could land heavy guns. But that was the job we were mainly concerned with, intelligence and checking. Because, as you know, beaches, you can land a tank straight down it goes.
Yeah. Bit of a change from Alamein, wasn't it?
Quite. It was the same as people in England would recall the devastation in and about London. Of course, here, it didn't burn. Had it burned, it would have been a different story.
Ah.
In the desert, you were the target, Charles.
Yeah.
Here, the island was the target.
Target, yes.
And it was a different feeling, actually.
Yeah.
What I remember most, of course, although times we were hungry in the desert, it was nothing compared with what they went through here.
Very
and that's what I remember most about it.
Ladies and gentlemen, we drink to those we love, wherever they be, on land or sea, or in the skies above. We drink to every mother's son, on whom our land depends. So raise your glasses, everyone.
This is Charlie Chester on 88 to 91 FM, Radio 2 from the BBC.
The news at 11 o'clock. This is Fran Godfrey. Representatives from more than 50 countries have joined the Queen and other members of the royal family at St. Paul's Cathedral for a service marking the 50th anniversary of the end of the Second World War. The service of thanksgiving, reconciliation and hope is the main religious ceremony of the commemorations marking Victory in Europe Day. Hundreds of people have gathered outside the cathedral to watch the arrival of the dignitaries. The Chancellor, Kenneth Clark, has admitted the government must do more to communicate its policies to the electorate. Interviewed on BBC television this morning, Mr. Clark said it was the job of ministers to show that the government's policies were working. Despite the Tories' poor support in the local elections, he said he believed the electorate was waiting to be persuaded to vote Conservative. Nearly a week after Croatian forces launched an offensive on western Slavonia, there are still doubts about the fate of some of the Serbs who fled the fighting. Many remain unaccounted for and a number are feared dead. Paul Adams visited some of the thousands of refugees who fled to Bosnia and heard claims that many of them were fired on by the Croatian army.
Serb refugees at Nova Topola have little to do except congregate around the town's makeshift reception centre and brood on the events of the past week. they're still extremely angry about what's happened to them and vent their feelings on any foreigners they see. Inevitably, a sense of communal rage has fueled the memories of what happened on Monday and Tuesday. But it's clear from the consistency of the stories they tell that a number, perhaps a large number, of Serbs were killed as they tried to escape the Croatian onslaught.
The search is continuing in Norfolk for an 8-year-old boy who was reported missing yesterday. He was last seen playing on a beach at Hunstanton. Police officers have been checking fairgrounds and holiday camps, and an RAF helicopter has been called in to help. French voters are going to the polls in the final round of the country's presidential elections. The gap between the two candidates, the socialist colleague Lionel Jospin and the conservative Jacques Chirac, is thought to have narrowed over the last few days. A 16-year-old youth has been charged with causing grievous bodily harm after an incident involving a machete in Oxford yesterday. Four men were injured, two are reported to be in a satisfactory condition after undergoing surgery. A reward is being offered for a flyaway Kent parrot, which whistles wartime tunes. 8-year-old Polly was all set to take centre stage at VE Day celebrations in the village of Hartley tomorrow, but he's disappeared. His owner, Mike Ridley, says his talents will be sorely missed.
He shouts like the children, he whistles for the dog, he barks like a dog, says hello in all the voices of everybody in the house, and he can also whistle the Dambusters very, very badly. He can do Colonel Bogey, he can do the Bluebirds over the White Cliffs of Dover, and his party piece is the opening bars of Rule Britannia.
It's a sight better than me, I can tell you. And the weather, southern England and south Wales will be warm and sunny. Cooler, cloudier weather with some rain in the north will spread southeast during the day. BBC News, it's 3 minutes past 11, our next at midday.
Between 88 and 91 FM, this is Radio 2, Charlie Chester.
Welcome back to The Price of Victory.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Though there's one motor gone, we can still carry on. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. What a show, what a fight. Yes, we really hit our target for tonight. How we sing as we limp through the air. Look below, there's our field over there. With our full crew aboard and our trust in the Lord, we're coming in on a wing and a prayer.
Started before the war in the Air Force, with Pyle Dobson, in 35, and got shot up twice. Once in 1940 over Norway. I did the first bombing raid on Trondheim when Hitler invaded on the 10th of April, invaded Norway. We went on the 17th, 18th, 19th. And it's a 12-hour flight, incidentally. 6 hours there and 6 hours back.
Of course, yeah. Yeah. You forget
and you're sitting in the same position. You don't get up and move about. Unfortunately, on the first trip, six of us went. Two coming back hit the Grampian Mountains and poof, that was it. Next night, six more. You're briefed at midday, and then they tell you after a short meal to go and have a lie down in the afternoon. And I lay on the bed for 2 hours, and I was asleep, and I saw a black square, very small. And this black square kept coming closer and closer to me until it rushed at me, went bang, and what was on it was a white skull and crossbone.
Oh, my God, yes.
And I thought to myself, boy, you're not coming back from this one.
Oh, dear.
And they were right. Well, lived, but the plane didn't come back. The engine was set on fire over Trondheim Field. I turned around, tried to get back as far as I could, but got back about 50 miles between from there to North Shetland, and was coming down 10,000 feet on one engine when it went into a dive at 500 feet. I thought, well, nobody can live out of this because you're just going zoom straight in.
Yeah.
So I just stood up and sort of count up to 20 or hum God Save the King or something like that.
Yeah.
I thought, this is going to be it, you see. So the next thing was an enormous crash which sounded like 1,000 panes of glass shattering, and I was not unconscious, of course. I found out later I'd been thrown from where I was right into the nose of the aircraft, Because when I came round, the bottom half was underwater and the top half on fire.
And I must take your choice.
Yes, take your choice. It's one way or the other. I just found one in between. Because I must have crawled through the wreckage with my fingers. I can't remember doing it. And I was just about to go out when I thought, God, where are the others? And they must be outside. And about to go after them, I looked down the tail, and there in a package, about 2 foot big like a suitcase, was a rubber dinghy. So I did a sort of dive for that, pulled it to the water and flung it towards the tail where it was dark, and dived in after it. Well, the Mae West, you pop up. They do work.
They do work.
Yeah, you go in and go, whoop, whoop. Unfortunately, I came up between two slivers of fire. And I had to swim on my back, open the dinghy in the water by pulling on the string, and I'd go, being opened. Well, I couldn't get in. But two, well, that couldn't swim were hanging on the tail. I'd asked them on the way down who could swim, who couldn't.
Yeah.
And those two who couldn't, as well, you keep your bits on.
Yeah.
Your fur coats.
Yeah.
I'll take all mine off except braces. I'll have to do a bit of swimming for you and hang on to me.
I see.
And I got them in to the dinghy. But when they sat up, we crashed downwind. It acted like a sail and blew us into flames, which were anything from 20 feet, 30 feet up. Then, well, like a petrol flame does when it goes. All black clouds of smoke. So I had a hold on the string of the dinghy, threw on my back. I didn't know I was doing it with one arm, one leg at that time, and pull it away from the flames.
Yeah.
But the more I swam, the distance was about 6 yards.
Yeah.
We never got any further away because we'd gone downwind.
Oh, I see.
See, and been blown in. Learning to do, I'd read at school some books by Mesmer and Kuei on how you can train the mind to do things. And I kept on saying, if I go unconscious, you must keep on doing these jerks with your legs and arms,
keep
which
going.
I did.
Yeah.
Because they said you passed out twice, but you never stopped swimming. And I was pulling this thing, and at one time it got so hot, these things on my face, because I was the only one looking up at it, they were like this. I thought, face will get burned. I took a deep breath of this stuff, put my head under the water, swam 3 strokes, came up for one, went back, and kept on going like that. But after 10 minutes, the last I saw was the tail turret on fire disappear under the sea, and then it was pitch dark. They tried to pull me in and couldn't, because the thing had opened upside down and the strings are hanging underneath.
Oh.
And the 1 foot swimming got caught in the wire and string, and they couldn't pull me out. So I said, what are you going to do, sir? I said, you need to bother about calling me sir in the Arctic Circle. I said, I'll hang on here for an hour and get breath back. Then I'd go underneath in the dark and feel for the knot sort of string and undo it. And in the end, I undid it. And they pulled me in after about an hour or two. It was very cold. We were below the Arctic Circle, north of 150 miles north of Shetland. The medics say you can't live more than half an hour. I live 6 hours.
6 hours?
Yes, it's a spiritual thing. There comes a point in life where fear is cut off. Because there is nothing more to fear. You know that you are looking into eternity, and therefore all is peace.
Yeah.
When the airplane's on fire and you're struggling for control and trying to do a good landing in a crash, there's fear, you're frightened, you're doing things.
But when it's all
but over. When it's all over and you really come to the final moment, there's lovely peace, and it also gives you strength. I said to myself, you will get me in the end. Now, I've got two choices. One, I can put my head back and open my mouth and go, and that's it.
Yeah.
Or I can say, right, I'll take you on.
Yeah.
I say, you've got to get me first. And yeah. That's the way I did it. I said,
one.
You'll take me first.
Marvelous.
And therefore I'll stay. And at 6 in the morning, bing, there's a flash of light, and it's a searchlight. And that came about because a destroyer was coming by about 30 yards past me. This is a million to one chance.
Yeah.
It was still dark. The clouds came apart and a moonbeam came down on the water.
Yes.
And a little sailor in the bows saw a black dot. So I thought, well, I'll shout out, are you British? And if he said, man, the fire and gig in England, I was going to say, don't want any help, thank you, quite all right, I'm doing very well. I didn't realise then I broke my leg, crushed my foot, fractured my skull and bust both eardrums.
Been
shaking about. No doctor on board. His foot was black from there to there. He couldn't see where his foot was. Yellow from there to, up to my hip. And he said, bottle of whiskey, 20 cigarettes, give him a box of matches, tell him to get on with it. Nelson did.
Colditz is an old Saxon schloss,
a sort of chateau. As you approach it, it looks at first sight rather forbidding and is somewhat dilapidated. It isn't set romantically on a high mountain, veiled in clouds and surrounded by wild forests. It's actually on the side of a hill just on the edge of the town, standing on solid white rock. In its days as a prison, the castle used to be surrounded by high sentry posts with floodlights and machine guns and, of course, fence after fence of barbed wire.
Now, over there, those are the kitchen windows at the top there. They're taking the bars off where Pat Reed came across.
This is the first courtyard. The second one has only one exit, and this was the second courtyard where the soldiers were kept. Mm-hmm. So there was just one exit to be guarded.
That building was sort of kind of divided in two, German this side and British the other, so that they had a common wall between the two. So if you broke through, you would come into the German side. And once you got into the German side, there are all sorts of avenues that you could consider. One is to come out of those windows and drop down onto the roof. And where those two workmen are standing, just about in that corner, they found a ventilation shaft. They disappeared down that, and it took them out. Their main difficulty was to get their bodies through it. They had to take all their clothes off in the cellar to get out because, I mean, you'd be all right, you'd get through. But, I mean, I wouldn't, you see. It was just, I should think, about 12 and a half inches wide. I think Pat got through first. He was probably much slimmer. And then he had one or two bulky chaps. He was naked.
Yeah, yes.
He had to catch hold of these chaps and heave them through, scraping them as they went.
Oh.
It was that narrow.
Historians know that they have digged a tunnel there, and they are doing some research work and finding how actually it was. They know approximately where it all was.
We can tell them exactly where it was. So this was the one and only tunnel that came out of Kildare.
They relayed the floor.
Dirty trick.
How inconsiderate.
Oh, yeah. There is where it started. We spent the winter of 1940 digging that one out.
The British officers were in this track?
Sometimes.
The French officers were above the chapel. And in the attic was where the glider was.
The glider, well, that was built right up there, the very, very top. The first thing, obviously, was the scheme. Then, where the hell are you going to build it? What are you going to build it of? Fairly simple. I mean, you build it of what's available. And eventually we made this workshop up in the top of the attic by shortening the roof over the chapel, which is a long, thin roof with no skylights into it. And we put up a false wall, covered it in palliasse covers, muddied it over, and prayed for a week that the Germans wouldn't go up. They didn't happen to go up in that attic. It takes a week for the mud to dry out. And there was our workshop, which was probably 7 feet wide by 20, 25 feet long and about 30 feet high. Eventually, we even had electric light in there. Why we didn't have a father, Lord alone knows, with all the shavings lying about, people smoking in glue pots, we wouldn't have minded if there had been a fire.
And the aim
anyway
of the project?
We'd make a hole in the end of the roof there, take it out, and assemble it, hoping nobody fell overboard, have a rope and a ton weight, put the two people in, give a good push and pray. I think would be the answer on that. It was utterly and completely finished by 4 or 5 months before the end of the war. But by then, all escaping had stopped on orders from England.
You had quite a sophisticated system of warning signals when people were working on projects at which they mustn't be caught.
Oh, yes. When we were working on the glider, in the top row of windows up behind you on the left there, we had one of our 12 apostles who was only on duty for half an hour because he had such a arduous job to do, and he had a lot of coloured cigarette tins and things like that and the odd coloured towel, and by hanging them out he could give us signals because we'd made a little hole about an inch diameter in the tile right up on the top there.
Well, you peered down through a tiny little slit between two slates that we'd made. You peered down to a window where there was somebody with signs that he put out when the Germans came in the courtyard. Well, one day I was down in the courtyard and I was talking to Pupko, who was one of the German officers, the Lager officer. And in this particular day, we were just standing there. One of the fellows had made a scale model of the glider, and he catapulted it out of one of the top windows. It flew down beautifully and landed perfectly. And Pupka simply remarked, "Well, I'm glad to see that the British officers are doing something sensible, making models, instead of trying to escape."
You know, our soldiers were told that it was their duty to try and escape. And it's a known fact that although frustrated and angry at every escape attempt, the Germans openly stated their admiration for the ingenuity and variety of methods used, many ending in failure, but some in success. Patience, secrecy, and detailed planning were the watchwords, doing the same thing day after day so that the guards got used to seeing it.
Now, the other very, very famous and well-known escape took place just round the corner here. The plot was this, that Franz Josef was a Feldwebel, that's a staff sergeant it would be. He was portly. He had this huge moustache, face full of character, cap. He got the Iron Cross of the First World War, and he was a very important-looking chap with a big belly on him and so forth. Mike Sinclair and two others decided that they were going to have a plan whereby they were going to relieve the sentries on this side.
And the way they changed the guard here, there were a certain number of guard points around here, they were changed one at a time, not as we would do in England, march round the whole group of chaps, switching them over. So therefore, if they could swap over one, the alarm would not be given back at the guardhouse until Schultz had got back. So you have about 5 minutes start.
Mike Sinclair, having got these clothes and uniforms ready, he wore the exact uniform of the real Franz Josef. He spent literally months studying Franz Josef to get all his mannerisms. He even listened to his voice to get the right intonation. He was an Austrian, this chap, so he had to get the accent and the dialect right. And then they dressed up Lance Pope, who's a very good German speaker, as a German sentry in full German uniform, and Hyde Thompson, who was the other one. Three rifles were made, scabbards for bayonets, buckles, caps with proper cap badges on, iron crosses, metal ribbons, and everything else. And rifles complete that looked absolutely real. They knew it was going to be after dark, so it was quite possible that they would get away with this. The bars were cut in what we call the sick bay, which is just beyond this round little tower, and they came out on a rope, and they dropped down onto that terrace, which is doesn't show too well now, but it's slightly higher than the left-hand path. Now, they were inside of this sentry here, and we knew that it was quite possible, if the thing was coordinated sufficiently, to move in the times when sentries were looking the other way. It was a terrific preparation for this thing, particularly as we wanted two very particular guards, who we thought were complete dumbheads, to be on duty. The commander of the guard had to be the real Franz Josef at that particular time. It had to coincide with the light, of course, the type of night we were going on, what moon, etc. There was a big coordination to be done. Mike Sinclair, dressed as Franz Josef, marches in front of the two sentries, and he gets to the first sentry, and he tells him that he's required to go back to the guardroom, and he's to be relieved immediately. This sentry complied. He came up, and he stood there and allowed his post to be taken over by Hyde Thompson. The little party then went on. Mike Sinclair then spoke to the next sentry, You only had to relieve the two. He told him the same story. The German guard hesitated. He very nearly did it, but finally decided there was something wrong, and he asked Mike Sinclair for his identity card. And Mike then exploded in rage in German. Do you not recognize your own sergeant major? Anyway, the suspicion was there. The sentry pressed his alarm bell. Franz Joseph was called up, and he came around the corner, and of course he met his double. And everyone there were totally confused as to which was the proper one and which was the double. There was a good deal of shouting, a lot of orders being shouted, and Mike refused to give up. He just went on claiming that he was the correct one, and this other chap was the interloper. But inevitably, they got so excited that a corporal would run round from here and join them, drew his gun, and in the panic, he fired a shot, and it went through Mike's chest and missed his heart by half an inch. It went through his lungs. He dropped, bleeding profusely. The alarm bells went. The whole castle was in complete uproar because we knew what had gone on. The courtyard was a melee of most indignant and very angry prisoners, and the Germans were very excited indeed. Mike, fortunately, they collected him, put him in hospital, and he recovered.
There were other escape ideas being tried out. There was the successful escape of a French prisoner. For months, he did his morning exercise run around the barbed wire compound in the castle grounds, dressed only in running shorts and singlet. He did it with such monotony that soon the guards began to take no notice at all, until...
Now, we're going up the path here, down which the prisoners came when they were taking exercise. Behind these trees is an open path, which is wired off, and the prisoners who wanted to go, they'd be marched out through the commandantur yard and into a wired enclosure. And that was the area which was an exercise yard. There was a parallel bar there for those people that wanted to swing about. But mostly people played a bit of football, marched around the edge. And some very fine escapes were done from that park. There was a well there, which was used by the Dutch. I think they got three or four people away by various means of hiding them down this... Well, there are at least two people jumped clean over the wire. One Frenchman jumped with the help of two others, landed on the other side. He must have cleared 10 feet. He was an athlete, and he had running gear on. And, I mean, the story is he ran all the way to France. But, I mean, we don't believe that, but he never came back. And a week later, we got a card from him to say he made it. And there were several others. But it was one time when you're outside the castle, so you had the opportunities to think up all sorts of schemes.
Is that where Sinclair was killed, was it?
Towards the end of the war, Mike Sinclair tried to emulate this Frenchman who got away. He was walking around the yard with his great friend, David Schofield, and he said to him, almost on the spur of the moment, goodbye, just like that. And he ran to the wire. He climbed it. He dropped on the other side, and he probably got about 10 yards before any of the sentries realized what he was doing. He was running, and they had to then load their rifles, and they began firing. And very unluckily, he had one bullet, which hit his elbow and was deflected into his heart.
Oh.
And he was killed stone dead. Mike Sinclair was the most renowned escaper of... we say, of all time. He escaped 7 or 8 times, and he was caught on at least 3 frontiers and brought back to Curlew.
On May the 29th, Radio 2 is offering you the unique opportunity to see American superstar Natalie Cole live in concert in Birmingham.
What a day this has been. What a rare mood I'm in.
Would you like to be part of this unforgettable musical event?
Unforgettable in every way.
Don't miss out on Music Live 95. Book your tickets now for Natalie Cole.
I miss you like crazy. I miss you like crazy.
To book tickets for this concert and to get full listings for Music Live 95, call 0121 782 9595. 0121 782 9595. BBC Radio Music Live 95. Live it.
Radio. Hear the D-Day Dodgers out in Italy. Always on the vino, always on the spree. Eight Barney Stivers in our tanks. We live in Rome among the Yanks. We are the D-Day Dodgers in sunny Italy.
The little town of Cassino is at the foot of the great mountain Monte Cassino, on which stands the abbey, the resting place of St. Benedict. It's some 75 miles to the south of Rome, and was the scene of some of the hardest fighting of the war. Four epic battles it took to capture the mountain, and included the forces of the Polish, the Indian Army, New Zealanders, Canadians, the Scottish, the Irish, the Americans, and the English, including those men of the 8th Army having won a victory in the desert of North Africa. These were the men who made a joke in song about having been delayed by the fighting in Italy, thereby missing the Normandy invasion, and calling themselves the D-Day Dodgers.
I'm standing in a stone sanger with a breastwork of stones and boulders piled up round me on a spur overlooking the valley of the Rapido River. Just off to my right here, there's a haystack, or at least it was a haystack, but now it's just a hollow mockery, for it's been scooped out inside, and it's obviously been in use recently as a machine gun post. Some of the discarded ammunition is still lying round about it, and the trees around here have been cut off to give it a field of fire. From here, we get a really magnificent view of Cassino Town and the country around it. At this distance, Cassino looks just like a normal town. Perhaps a bit untidy, but nothing badly amiss. That's at a range of about a mile and a half.
Cassino Town, when we found it on the morning of its capture, wasn't a place anymore. It was a great grey dust heap of stones that had been buildings, skeletons that had been houses, craters, and great mounds of masonry where roads had been. That was all remaining of a historic Italian town. As British troops went through, mopping it up, the place was full of mines and booby traps. It remained eminently unsafe, but to every eye, a graveyard.
It's the morning of the 18th of May, and I'm standing on a little road, a track almost, on the lower slopes of Monte Cassino. The smoke is climbing up the face of the mountain, right up towards the monastery. And this very morning, a few hours ago, the monastery was entered by the Poles. The valley's full of smoke, and still up on the upper slopes there's firing going on. Down the road has just come a Polish officer. He's come down the little slope, the little path, from that monastery up on the top, and he's been carrying in his hand some books and two roses, one of which he's given to me. It seems fantastic things for him to bring down from Monte Cassino.
And there, on top of the ruined abbey, they planted a flagstaff, on which, in a moment, the red and white Polish flag fluttered out against the sky. And then the Union Jack was put up beside it.
in the Polish brigade?
The first on the top, because we had our third Carpathian division, was assigned to take the monastery. But of course, there are British army on the left, and the Americans, and all of us, because of action and of the other armed forces, we were successful to do our assignment.
You don't hold any bitterness, though, do you, Alex?
No. There was war and ambitions of great people.
I was in the Queenstown Cameron Highlands right here at Casino. Mm-hmm. I worked with the Camerons in the 4th Indian Division.
It must have been terrible with mules going up that side of that mountain. My goodness.
It was a long walk.
I bet it was.
And then the sad thing was, of course, if the mules bucked, you know, with the bangs and the wallops and everything, then the food and the panniers at the sides would go over the mule and then it would bolt or they would get shrapnel and stuff. Yes.
What does that old mountain look like after all these years?
Well, it terrified me at the time, you know, looking up at that Valhalla above us, covered in smoke from our artillery fire. I was terrified because the Germans were looking down our throats there, you know. I was in the 6th Armored Division Signals. I was a signal officer, and I had to replenish the tanks in the evening after the battle was over. Casinos suddenly become a very prosperous town and very much a center of tourism. People who come to see this famous monastery that was destroyed by the flying fortresses of the American army. Anything that would have happened to Casino after that would have been enhancement because it was just a pile of bricks. I don't know whether you realize, Charlie, there were 36 different nations sending soldiers to this battle at Casino.
We had an attack order to set up a roadblock on the road leading to the Abbey on the 8th of February. We were unsuccessful, and myself and my comrades were taken prisoner. Eventually, we ended up in Germany, and after several months, when contact was made with my mother, I received a letter from her, and it said, by the way, if you hear from an English girl, write to her because, and the rest was all censored. Eventually, I did get a letter from Sheila, and I returned the letter, and we continued corresponding. Became pen pals.
Yeah.
Eventually, I returned home after the war and continued writing. And on the 26th of July, 1948, we were married.
Well, actually, I was born in a town exactly the same meaning as Dewsbury. And it's a town called in Germany, a town called Duisburg.
Uh-huh.
And I was bred and born there, of course. And then when I was 18, like every other lad got call-up papers, and I were called up into the forces, and I volunteered for the paratroopers.
You've got a lovely German accent. You really have.
I know. Everybody says this. The funny thing is, actually, while I was fighting as a German para, top of Rocca Nulla, I have a brother-in-law who were a paratrooper on the English side fighting in Monte Cassino.
So your enemy became your brother-in-law?
It certainly did, yes. And there's one incident where I went into attack on Rocca Nulla. And we were heavily beaten back anyway. And there were quite a lot wounded and one or two lads killed and one or two lads taken prisoner of war. And the war did stop for about 4 hours. And we borrowed stretchers from the English side and took the wounded back up. Not only that, the lads took the stretchers back to them. Rocca Nulla gave them back and they came back with pockets full of chocolate and cigarettes and all sorts of things. And you were killing one another, yet you were helping one another.
Yeah,
you cannot believe it, what went on here.
Sea wash on a deserted sandy beach in Normandy, northern France. 50 years ago, this was part of an area designated Sword Beach. The Allied landings on D-Day, the 6th of June, 1944. The landings that were to break through Hitler's Atlantic Wall and spread across France into the Low Countries and ultimately end World War II. All is quiet now,
Here and there are groups of children playing on the beaches and in the sand dunes, a coastline of quiet seaside resorts, and a countryside of rolling farmland and picturesque villages. A far cry from the mayhem and bloodshed 50 years ago.
This particular night, the bombardments, or whatever, started round about 11 o'clock at night. And, of course, that was always music in my ears. The window panes started to rattle. In fact, the window frames started to rattle, and I knew there was something big. Then aircraft came over, and as usual, one heard bombardments in the region, and within 20 minutes, the planes came back again. But instead of that being the end of the pleasurable noises I heard, it went on until about 1 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, now this is something special. The next morning I got to the workshop and the other two lads were so excited that they'd run to the house to listen to the first news, which came from London.
Yeah.
And in about 10 minutes I heard Madame Hubie shouting from the courtyard, "Jean! Ils sont arrivés!"
Came down just over there in the horse glider. And the idea was to tack this bridge over this way.
Yeah.
I was being detailed to be the last man out of the glider.
He was detailed to be last. If there's anybody had the jitters, he was to throw them out.
What time was this?
Just after midnight, about 16 minutes past 12.
It pitch black.
After midnight. Pitch black. Yes. A Jerry machine gun opened up on the bank, and I was alongside Lieutenant Fox, who was in charge. And he yelled out, "Sergeant, silence that gun." And that sergeant was Wagger Thornton. Mm-hmm. And he fired a grenade, and that shut the gun up. We could hear the defenders running. And that's the only shot we had fired at us. And you could hear them running off down the footpath.
Really?
That's right. I mean, the sound of us rushing over the bridge, there was 30 pairs of hobnail boots. So, I mean, time for them to go.
Yeah. I went to bed in my mother's room. Suddenly, we heard a tremendous crashing noise, which appeared to be sounding as though it was on the other side of the canal. So my father called out, "Therese, will you please take the two children down in the cellar?" And I was taken down into the cellar. It was dark because we didn't dare put the electricity on. So it was really very, very frightening. And then suddenly we heard above our head that one of the shutters was being cracked and open. Somebody had entered. Somebody tripped over either a chair or a crate and let out a few words, which to my father sounded in English.
Invectives.
Absolutely. And my father said to himself, "Well, I know English very well. It couldn't be the German speaking in such good English." So he opened the door, and it was the first time that he realized that they were not Germans. He asked them if they were English, and he said, "Êtes-vous anglais?" And they replied, "Oui, nous sommes anglais." And for the first time, I saw with my mother and my sister the first British soldiers with blackened faces and their helmets and their nets. But I was given some chocolates and some biscuits, and it was a wonderful moment.
I landed straight in front, about 5 yards in front of a German machine gun. Fortunately, just before I took off, I was handed a Bren gun magazine that somebody couldn't carry, and I slipped it in my inside left pocket. And when I landed, I got this burst straight at me. Well, one bullet went just below the button of the breast pocket. I had a tin of cigarettes in the outside pocket, and the bullet went straight through the middle of the tin of cigarettes into the Bren gun magazine stock, which is in line for my heart. But I arrived at this tower at the back of the church.
There's three doors here. Which one did you choose?
One on the left. I think it was the first one I opened. It was a toilet with a box seat. There was something to sit on, so I decided to take advantage of it. So I went in and shut the door and just sat on the toilet. My arm at this time was getting stiff. I couldn't use it, so I was disabled. And then a little bit later on, I heard a little scuffle outside the door. When I just pushed the door open slightly, there was a German soldier with half his foot blown away.
Oh.
And he was in a lot of pain and obviously in distress, so I grabbed him by the collar and dragged him into the toilet. Then I went to give him a cigarette because he was obviously in a lot of distress. And when I pulled my cigarette in out, I got a hole through the middle. The cigarettes were all mashed up. So I went and made a gesture, wanted to know if he got any cigarettes. So he brought out a packet, so we sat smoking his cigarette.
Emil decided to become a dog handler, and he was given the most beautiful Alsatian dog. Once he got hold of the dog and he started to look after it, he became a completely changed person.
Really?
Absolutely changed. He went quiet. He went considerate. He couldn't do enough for the dog. And then he slapped it in a dummy fuselage of aircraft to get it used to an aircraft fuselage, being in an aircraft fuselage.
The dog, he taught it to jump.
He taught it to jump from a moving aircraft.
Really?
Now, having taught it to jump from a moving aircraft, he then got the pilot to rev the engine, and when it throttled back, as it would do when it was stalling to drop parachutes, he taught the dog to automatically jump at his command.
Good God.
So that the dog knew exactly when Emil was going to say jump, and it would jump first before he jumped. It had a special harness and parachute made for it. It was a bicycle parachute, a parachute that we used to drop holding bicycles on, and they adapted it with a special harness to fit the dog, so that the dog's hind legs were lower than his front legs. So when he hit the ground, his hind legs hit the ground first.
Yeah.
And it had a little red light attached to its harness, so that if it dropped in the darkness, he could be found. And of course, parachutes don't always drop when there's no wind about. So he taught it, because the wind was liable to get in the chute and drag the dog miles away.
Yes.
He taught the dog, when he came down and there was a wind about and he was getting dragged, to run round his chute in a circle and then sit on the parachute to collapse it until he arrived to free it.
Good gracious.
Now, unfortunately, during D-Day, the RAF had been given orders to strap any moving personnel outside a certain area. And he, unfortunately, got dropped outside that area, and most of the people got killed, including Emil and his dog. Well, when they went back to the spot where this had happened, they found that the dog was still on its lead, and the lead was still in Emil's hand. And because of that, they decided that as they couldn't be parted in life, that they should remain together in death. And they buried them together here in the cemetery.
That's one of the most moving stories, I think, of the war. I really do.
Coming over, to start off with, wasn't too bad.
Mm-hmm.
We were towing two LCAs for the commandos to go in on the beach. Whoosh! The shell came through the stack of the LCG.
Yeah.
It fractured all the exhaust pipes from the engines. All the fumes started coming down into the engine room. I had no one else in the engine room with me, but I had my gas mask, so I put my gas mask on for to...
Out-breathe,
with the vibrations from the guns, all the lights go out. You see, it bursts the lights in in the engine room. With the
pipes and no lights.
Well, we were in that close, and machine gun bullets was rattling all up the starboard side of the craft. I thought of my mother and my father, and brothers and sisters, you know, and my girlfriend. We were hit about 100 times and all, or more. The Germans ran from their positions, the boys told me, across some fields on the left-hand side. And... of course, the boys put the Orlikans after them, what I called small arms fire.
Yeah, yeah.
They ran from there, so there was no opposition on that beach for the boys to go in at that particular time in the morning. When I got on deck and was talking to the lads, they was telling me how things had gone. They said they'd knocked out 9 88mm guns, besides the other, and that the skipper had said, you see the steeple of that church? He said, One round only, if you put a shell through the middle of that steeple, I will give the orders to splice the main brace. You'll get a double tot of rum.
Really?
Yes. So the trainer and the layer, straight through the shell, straight through the middle of the steeple. And we spliced the main brace at Aramanji's on D morning, about 9:20.
Eventually we got nearer to the Normandy coast.
Yeah.
And there was... searchlights going up, etc. A lot of tracer bullets, a few shells, and the ship's captain ran the ship as close to the beach as he could, and he lowered the ramp. So the captain said, you know, right, the first vehicle off, down the ramp it went, and completely vanished. He dropped his ramp at the edge of a bomb crater.
Oh.
So the captain, he moved his ship just a little bit and resided the ramp, And, of course, he said, like, next driver off. And strangely, there was no next driver wanting to go off. I mean, we were all, carpenters, you know, rent collectors, things like that, yeah. Painters.
Yeah.
And no John Wayne's there.
When the time came to be sent off into the sea, the first two tanks went off, the number one on the LCT, called the other tank, and only the driver could see his hand signal, went down the ramp with no screen. They went straight down into the bottom of the seabed. Took his crew with him, but the turret crew, the gunner, radio operator, and the troop officer got out. And they managed to get ashore sometime during the day.
On the way into the beach, when we were sort of getting quite keyed up to hit the beach, the barge rammed an underwater obstacle and hit a mine. They sent a lad down to test the depth, and it turned out to be 8 foot. They had a great big roll of matting. The idea was to pull that off to give a safe surface for the vehicles to follow. I said, but, you know, I've got my hands full. A wireless set, a mine detector. I think we had two capes, God knows what. But anyway, and I'm only the 5 foot. Weighed as it came right up. Instead of hanging around my waist, I wrap around my shoulders here in the May West. Anyway, down I went into 8 foot of water. The May West brought us back up again. My helmet floated off out to sea.
Well, that's nice.
And started trying to strike out for the shore. And I looked around. There was a medical corps lad alongside me. I said, Charlie, I'm not going to make this. I said, I have to make for that. I said, I just have to let go of the rope. He said, well, I should. You're the only bloody fool pulling.
On the morning of D-Day, after we moved up from the beaches, there were so many casualties in this area that they didn't know what to do with them. So my friend of mine, who was a medic, set up an RAP in this church, and people were bringing the wounded in. When I brought some fellas in, practically every pew had a wounded man laying on them or sitting in them, and on the floor as well. Up that end, there was just completely full of wounded. And the local women had come in with sheets, anything they could get hold of, to help, along with some Sisters of Mercy, or nuns.
What was your unit?
The Hampshire Regiment. You see, my battalion alone, in the first few hours, suffered 60 killed and 122 wounded. Really? Out of the battalion, which is only about 550 strong. We took quite a battering.
You did.
And then, of course, we had men from the Dorsets being wounded, and, of course, the auxiliary services, like engineers and the tank men. But it was amazing the way the local people rallied round, the women,
Pretty little church, isn't it?
It is. It's beautiful.
Quite old.
Yes. I never got a chance to look at it at the time, Charlie.
Did we ever walk through?
Yes.
How many pews are there? Are these all... There's a quiet little graveyard by the church at Old Annell, and across the lane a field where daisies grow, with a cottage on the corner where a lonely horse is grazing by a broken wall that gave up years ago. It's silent and it's rugged, just a rustic souvenir, yet a place that holds such memories today of the wounded men inside the church laid out on every pew from Gold Beach, where so many had to stay.
The thing that struck me about these sand dunes when I came here was they're exactly the same sand dunes as I remember seeing at Porthcawl and Barry Island, or really anywhere on the Welsh coast.
Yeah.
The only difference with these sand dunes to the one I remember back home was the hundreds of crosses that were on them. Yes. Small crosses. No names on them, just numbers. Yes. One NCO, four men, Lancashire Fusiliers.
Yes.
Six men, Sherwood Foresters. And there were so many of them. Yes. It's incredible.
Yes.
And no names.
Yes,
all makes... numbers. And they'd just been buried where they'd fallen.
Yes.
Yeah, so many of them. Yes. And just these sand dunes the same as we got back home.
And it all happened 50 years ago. During the last 90 minutes, you've heard just a few stories from those who contributed to what culminated in Victory in Europe Day in 1945. You've heard from those who came back to tell their stories, and you've heard the stories about many more who, as I said at the beginning of the program, didn't return to their families, soldiers, sailors, and airmen whose lives were cut off in their prime, although they may have returned, whose lives would never be the same again. And the events we have included are simply a few sample recollections from people I've met over the years, ordinary men and women who represent the hundreds of thousands who made their contributions to Victory when it came in 1945. During the program, we've heard from those who were at Dunkirk, the great miracle rescue at the beginning of the war, when the little ships brought back a third of a million men from the beaches of France and Belgium. We've heard from those who lived through the days of the great siege of Malta, the little Mediterranean island whose bravery and fortitude were rewarded by King George VI when he awarded the George Cross to the island and her people. We've heard, too, about the RAF bomber crew who came down in the North Sea and, against all odds, survived for over 6 hours in waters that the experts said would kill a man in 30 minutes. And then, by a million to one chance, were spotted at the dead of night by a lookout on a Royal Naval destroyer. Some of the ex-inmates of Colditz Castle gave us an insight into the indomitable spirit inside Germany's supposedly escape-proof prison camp. Only it wasn't. And those who served in Italy and missed the invasion of France across the Channel and who turned round what was meant to be a jibe are now proud to count themselves among the D-Day Dodgers. And we ended with the beginning of the end, stories from those who took part in the greatest armada in history, D-Day. Where were you on VE Day? Perhaps you were not even born. One of my contributors who landed in France on D-Day, then ended up in the heart of Germany, recently wrote to me. We never saw all those cheering crowds in London or the marches through the streets. We were carrying on as usual, but without the roar of guns. Many who had stopped fighting in Europe were then sent straight off to the Far East or to other parts of the world. Very few were sent back to England immediately. So when newspapers ask ex-servicemen what they were doing on VE Day, the answers are probably not what they expected. Well, whatever you're doing this VE Day weekend, make a moment to remember, too, the days, the years before, the years that made it happen, the years of wearying, slogging, hardship, of shortage, rationing and hunger, of bereavement and sadness. This VE Day 50th anniversary is a time of celebration and commemoration, so let's do both. But remember, too, those who paid the price of victory.
To commemorate an extraordinary moment in history, Radio 2 is putting together an extraordinary day of programmes.
Join me, Terry Wogan, from 7:30, live from a signal box at Crewe Heritage Centre, as I turn back the clock with a group of wartime evacuees. And I'll be followed by Mr. Ken Bruce. From 9:30, I'll be fulfilling some listeners' requests and selecting a pick of the wartime hits.
On the Jimmy Young programme, I shall be joined by Claire Rayner, Lord and Lady Healy, Sir Dirk Bogarde and Sir Edward Heath.
And at 1, join me, Sarah Kennedy, when I'll be talking to a woman pilot who flew during the war. Don't miss Winston Churchill's famous VE Day announcement. We broadcast at 3. And then it's party time.
Join me, Ed Stewart, in Liverpool for one of the nation's biggest, brightest VE Day street parties.
VE Day on BBC Radio 2.